everybody. This is William Del Pilar. This is Points on the Board. And I am here with my co-host, Eddie Aparicio. Eddie, my friend, brother.
What's up, Guillermo? I'm good, man. How you been, man? Happy New Year, happy holidays, all that stuff. Hope you had a good one with your family. Definitely it was jam-packed for me. I was nonstop for the most part. But, you know, anytime you spend time with the family, you fatten up a little bit, right? And you get to enjoy some, you know, some good quality time and get a chance to talk, watch movies, you know, the stuff that kind of relaxes you, right? And helps extend your life beyond what we deal with on a daily basis with all the stress that we deal with, right? So the holidays are there to help put back the years you may have lost as you're working.
I actually worked through the holidays. I got this venture.
I'm
working late nights, but it's been helping me. I wake up with less stress. I'm working later hours, but because I don't go to bed stressed about this wasn't done or that wasn't done or this wasn't done. I mean, you read the notes. They're much more detailed, much more laid out. I'm doing that. But Christmas movie. What Christmas movie did you watch this year?
You know, we didn't necessarily watch Christmas movies. We just watched, you know, like my wife and I, we love like kind of thriller kind of movies.
Yeah.
And then so there was one that I'll share with you. It was actually pretty decent. It's called Before I Wake, and it's about a kid who can dream, and whatever he dreams manifests into real life. So he actually sees things. But it's pretty cool. It's a pretty good movie, so I would recommend checking it out. It's not a family movie. It's a family movie. It's not scary. It's kind of marketed as a scary movie, but it's pretty good. And then another one I'll recommend is Silenced. It's a Netflix movie, and it's about a story about a guy who's trying to find you know, the killer of his daughter, and sees that there's a serial killer that's taking kids out, you know, in a certain part of the U.S. So. Not a family movie again, but it's a good movie to check out. So those are my Christmas movies.
Well, we don't watch new Christmas movies, or if we have, they're forgettable. The wife watches used to watch the Hallmark Christmas
movies. My wife watches all the time.
Yeah, she still watches them. But as far as us, we watch – she always starts watching the movies where they did – you know, she crashes out. But we watch – was it Fred Claus? Red Claus with the tall guy, I forget his name, famous actor.
Vince Vaughn?
Vince Vaughn, that's it, Vince, I'm thinking.
Vince Vaughn, yeah.
Vince Vaughn, that's enjoyable. Yeah. And I started watching Die Hard. I dumped Christmas Vacation just because you can only do it for so many years. And the second straight year I watched Die Hard and Fred Claus. I'm not into today's mood. I think the writing is too woke, too silly.
Yeah, I agree.
Not good writing. I find myself going back to the old classics more and more. You know, so
for sure.
Anyway,
another thing we should talk about, William, at some point for one of our introductory podcasts or the following one, is what are our top five best movies of all time? It would be interesting to get your take.
But they gotta be sports movies. It's a sports podcast.
Not necessarily sports. It could be.
Are you trying to become a guest on the Red, White, and Rude Entertainment Pop Culture podcast?
No, I'm just saying, you know, hey, you know, our listeners don't only they're not only focused on sports; they also look at other things too. So, you know, in this, you know, just kind of
I'm game for it.
Yeah.
So, real quick, Eddie, I know you know, and for the audience out there, a very dear individual. I'm not going to sit there and say. A good friend, because after I sold the business, you know, and you leave an industry, you tend to not talk. But I have talked to this individual once every few years, so we do stay in touch. And he's dear to me because I'm one of these people, Eddie. I'm like, never forget where you came from. Never, ever forget who helped you up that ladder, because one day you will come down that ladder. And this individual, his name is Emil Catholic, and he is a god in the fantasy sports industry. He's beloved by all the working class fantasy people. He's not as well beloved by the leadership cliques. He should have been an instant Hall of Fame entry person in the first couple of years. Took him over 10 years before they put him in. And the reason I say this is I know for sure at one point he was producing five magazines. The industry's changed, not the fantasy sports industry, but the print industry has changed over the last 15 to 20 years. dramatically. So I don't know how many he puts out. At one point, he may have had about 7 fantasy magazines. I don't remember. But that's how most people meet him. You know, you go to advertising his magazines. He needs writers. He understands the working class versus the Yahoo sales rep. If it wasn't for him, my company, KFFL, which at one point was ranked in the top 2,000 websites in the world, at one point we were the de facto leader in anything and everything to do with fantasy football as we grew our little mini empire out. We were the first NFL fantasy analyst for NFL. The Total Access show on NFL Network. We were one of the first. We were pioneers doing fantasy shows on satellite TV. We had our player news format, which came out at about the same time as RotoWire. I'm not going to take away from them, even though people have lied and said they were the first ones. They weren't. We were at about the same time. We owned them when it came to that. And all this happened because of the start of my relationship with Emil Kadlec. You know, I recognized what Emo's strategy was, and I maximized that. We'll write whatever article. We will do this, we'll do this. Just give us the advertising. But Emo and I became close as industry peers. You know, hey, Emo, I'm doing this show. Are you doing this show? Hey, you need a guest? Call Emo Cavendish or some of the fantasy sports shows we did. The pilot I did a year, some years ago, you know, Emo, went to Emo, him and Bob Harris. Emo's a godsend, and he is an endearing individual because he doesn't look at you to get what he can out of you. If he wants something, he wants a win-win. And he's very well beloved. And I found out just yesterday at 2 a.m. that he has pancreatic cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And it's not something that's like you said, I'm sorry to hear that. Or somebody said earlier, I'm sorry to hear you, he's battling that. And you don't do anything. There's no battling pancreatic cancer. From what I've read, from what I've known, it's you find a way to least painfully pass away.
Yeah. It's probably the most brutal one out of all of them, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure people have survived it, but it's one of those type of cancers you don't come back from. And that kind of shattered me for a few seconds because of what he represents. You know, and most people don't see him like I do. And I don't find that good or bad. But they should, but because without his help, the odds are your fantasy sports company would not have grown as quickly as it did, you know. So somebody said, well, you all just used each other. You wrote for him, you got a free ad. It was more than that. We grew into he was already a dinosaur in the industry when the industry first started its commercial explosion.
Yep.
So he was, and what made him different from a Charlie Weegar? And you may not know the name of Charlie Weegar.
I remember Charlie Weegar.
Yeah,
you did. CDM Sports.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you don't know that the average person has no clue Charlie Weegar is, but if you played fantasy sports, you had to mail it in or the fax or early on, odds are it was a Charlie Weegar produced company. You know? What made him different from Charlie is Emo was accessible to anyone. So was Charlie, but Charlie was more part of the power clique. He wanted to help lead the industry. He wanted to do this. Emo had no desire of that. Emo was having fun making magazines.
He's a grassroots guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he was having fun making magazines, meeting similar peers. Because remember, he was back before the internet and the industry came together. Nobody really knew anybody. So he was into that. So not that what Charlie did was bad. Not at all. It's just they took different paths.
And
I'll say this before we move on is I've come to realize scientifically it's proven we are beings of energy. Energy does not die. Something happens to it. So I no longer fear death in the traditional sense. As we grow up, we get scared to die. Not that I welcome it. You know, I still want to live a few more years. I don't look at death. It's like if my day comes tomorrow, I'm okay with it. But it's funny. I'm okay with that with myself. But I get heartbroken when it happens to others or bad things happen to others. That's just life, I guess. But my heart goes out to Emo, and I hope he can beat the odds and persevere. But it's one of the few times I get angry at God and go, why do you take the good ones and leave too many bad ones? That's just my opinion. But, man, when I think of Emo and what he's going through right now, that's what I think. And he's human. I'm sure he had his dark side.
Everybody has that.
But I never saw it. All I ever saw was a happy, and we would commiserate together too, whether it was about the clicks, how certain people treated us, or how the corporations wanted to take the smaller companies out, etc. But we also rejoiced and had a lot of more fun beers than not. And with that, we will move on to our show. But a shout out to Evil Cadillac and his right hand man Bob Harris, who early on Emo helped Bob so much, and now Bob's helping Emo, you know, that full circle. And that's a happy tale to see the growth of another human being because of one man, and that person he helped grow now is turning around to help him in his time of need. I mean, there's no greater giving of humanity to one another than that. You know, as hard as I am, I get kind of soft when it comes to things like that, because when you see people at their core and recognize good and bad, meaning a person who will throw you under the bus versus a person that never occurs, that's Emo Cadillac. And with that, Eddie,
I just want to say my condolences, not condolences, but you know, I'm sorry to the Emo family that, you know, that he's going through all this, and you know. We appreciate all your contributions. I met you a long time ago. I didn't know you very well, but I know who you were, and I know that you're a pioneer of the industry, and it's very much appreciated how much you influenced others to be able to jumpstart their own businesses in the fantasy sports industry. So thank you, Emo.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, thank you, Mr. Cadillac. Oh, and when people would always ask me for advice, you need to meet one person before anybody else, Emo Cadillac. And I did a lot of introductions. This is a win-win. Emo got a writer to help with Bobby to help, and they may or may not have gotten a free ad or got a reduced price on that ad. So God bless Emo. All right, Eddie, we got a great show today. We're still learning this process of combining entertainment with data, but we are growing and getting good at it. We're going to talk the Knicks and Raptors and their trade, and Big Eddie's going to break it down for us. We're also going to talk the Pistons losing streak. I had to find – my notes are massive, so I can't just scroll down and see them. So we're going to talk about the Pistons and losing streak, some quick hits with Mark Cuban, and I want to hear Eddie's take on Zion Williamson and the scale. We're going to talk some NFL, the playoff hunt, final season. Look, Eddie, this is not only the networks and streaming corporate bigwigs fantasy dream, their orgasm. It's also the NFL to have more than you can count playoff implications come the final week. So it's a big week. We're going to talk to MVP race, and Eddie, that's about a done deal, I believe. And Eddie and I are going to give you our best guesses on Black Monday. And that'll probably wrap it up. We have such a heavy show. And you know what the problem is? I came to realize this week is when I do a show, I lay it out like a radio show. And I had the epiphany today, the light bulb, the like, idiot, moron, kind of like Mo hitting Curly or Larry, you know? It's like, duh, radio shows are 4 hours long. That's why my shows can never be done in an hour. I'm putting enough content for a minimum of 2 to 3 hours, you know? And I realized exactly that last week, because I knew you probably saw all the stories, and you're probably thinking, what the bleep does he think we're going to talk about for an hour?
Right.
So I kind of partitioned that all out, but I need to not forget that. And with that, Eddie, let's get into it.
All right, let's do it.
Basketball. So the Knicks and Raptors make a big trade. The overview of this is Toronto sent offensive guard. So at first, I thought that was his initials. But offensive guard, how do you say that? Anunoby to New York in exchange for R.J. Barrett, Emmanuel Quickly, and a second-round pick. And so here's what they received. The Knicks received Anunoby, Malachi Flynn. Is that how you pronounce it?
Malachi Flynn.
That's it. Yeah. I've heard Malachi. It's not as uncommon a name. Malachi Flynn, Precious Achiuwa.
Achiuwa.
The Raptors receive R.J. Barrett, Emmanuel Quickly, and the 2024 second-round draft pick. And I had the names for those. I'll let you talk about that. But my first question to you is this trade. First, why were the players traded? Players are traded because they're no longer wanted, needed, or off the court issue, or whatever. So first question is, why did these teams get rid of these players? Second question is, what did the Knicks get out of it in terms of what their positives were, and what did the Raptors?
So I can tell you, so I'll look from the New York Knicks point of view first. The New York Knicks are a good team. They are a playoff contender. And they have a pretty good, or they have a pretty good player in Julius Randle, also Jalen Brunson. I mean, those two guys are really, really good players. RJ Barrett is a good player, but he's limited. He's limited because, you know, today's NBA, you have to be able to shoot. And he is a, I would say, kind of an average shooter. Yeah. He's very streaky, but he's more of a drive and kick kind of player. You know, he would thrive on a team that has a bunch of shooters already. And the Knicks really don't have much shooting. Other, you know, Quickley was a shooter, right? But he's a sixth man. He came off the bench. And it's primarily the reason why. And the primary reason why is because Tom Thibodeau, who's the coach of the New York Knicks, is a very defensive-minded coach. You know, he's the one who, you know, got Jimmy Butler started in his career at Chicago. And Jimmy Butler, when he came out of Marquette, was predominantly a defensive-minded player. And he evolved to become this two-way player that you see today where, you know, offense, he learned that over time and got good at it. But his foundation is defense, right? And that's what Tom Thibodeau wants. He wants more defensive-minded players. And Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley are definitely not that. Barrett, like I said, he's a limited offensive player. He would thrive in a different situation, and we can get to that once we talk about the Raptors. So it makes sense from the New York Knicks side as to why they want OG Anunoby, because OG Anunoby is actually a very, very good defensive player. He's a bigger guy, can shoot the three-point shot, but he's, you know, I think he was second-team All-NBA like last year. So he's got some defensive credentials, right? So he's got the ability to guard 1 through 5. And that's, you know, when you have a player that can do that, they are very, very coveted. And that's the reason why multiple teams, not just the Knicks, were inquiring about OG Anunoby. So I think it's a good fit for the Knicks. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, you know, losing, you know, kind of the sixth man guy from Emmanuel Quickley and how they shore up their shooting ability. Because the Knicks, that's their one weakness, is they really can't shoot very well. Now going to the Toronto Raptors point of view, Toronto Raptors, they gain Emmanuel Quickley because that team, the Raptors, is another team that is devoid of shooting. They are just, they don't have shooting. In today's NBA, you need to have some shooting, right? And they don't have it. Emmanuel Quickley immediately becomes a starter on the team. So he brings some offensive punch, and they already have a pretty good playmaker that's not necessarily a point guard, but he's a point forward in Scotty Barnes. So Scotty Barnes is a type of player that I think would help Emmanuel Quickley thrive offensively, because Emmanuel Quickley is one of these players that can shoot at all three levels. He can drive to the bucket, he can do a mid-range shot, and he can also do a three-point shot. So I think that's going to be a good fit for him. Now, RJ Barrett, that's the one that's kind of going to be, I think he's going to have a hard time fitting in there, honestly, because, you know, he's limited from an offensive standpoint. And like I said earlier, he's the type of player that would thrive in a situation where he can drive and kick, and then, you know, somebody else who shoots the three can get it, right? And then when those guys are guarded, he can go ahead and take it up to the bucket, because that's what he does. He's a very good driver.
So, Eddie.
So,
would you?
Yes.
When you say drive and kick, you're talking about somebody who dribbles it up and looks the other way, boop, passes the ball to whoever.
Yep. He passes the ball outside to a three-point shooter. Yes, that's what he can do, and that's what he does well. Because he's one of these downhill players. And like a Giannis Antetokounmpo, he's the epitome of a downhill player. He just drives to the bucket and takes over. No one wants to get in front of him. LeBron James, the same thing. They're big guys, really? But they're very skilled to be able to dribble the ball. And that's why these guys can drive and kick, because they're hard to guard. RJ Barrett is that kind of a player, but just not as big, right, as Giannis or LeBron, but he can drive and kick to these guys. So it's going to be interesting to see how RJ Barrett fares over at Toronto, but I can tell you, Emmanuel Quickley, I think that's a good fit for him. And I think, you know, but the other thing about Toronto is that they have a player in Pascal Siakam that's actually being shopped right now. You know, I think the Raptors are in a mode of trying to rebuild and retool their team. They have an emerging superstar in Scotty Barnes, and then now they have a shooter in Emmanuel Quickley. Now it's going to see what's going to happen with Pascal Siakam. We'll see.
Okay, my question to you, though, is you said retool and rebuild. It's either one or the other. If you're rebuilding, it's like you're going to be a loser as you get maturity, experience with a young team, and there's retool. It's like you think you're missing a few pieces. To give you an example, the Minnesota Vikings thought they were in a retooling season. You know, turns out they weren't. Yeah. So are they in a retooling or rebuilding mode? Or
I would say it's probably more of a retool than a rebuild. I kind of use those, you know, as in synonymous ways, right? I kind of use the word to mean for both, but yet to be, you know, particular about it. Yeah, you're right. It's rebuild is a bigger word, or it's a bigger change of your roster than a retool. Retool is more of a minor change, whereas rebuild is a complete change. So it's more of a retool for Toronto because I think they do have some pieces that are good on that team, but it's going to be interesting to see what they do with Pascal Siakam because he's definitely being shopped right now, and there's teams definitely interested in getting him.
Good, good. Yeah, Eddie, I make Latinos look dumb enough already. Get your words right, brother. I'm messing with you. So my original question then, this it seems like you answered it with the belief that this was trade was done for needs. It wasn't one team trying to get rid of a bad egg or a player demanding out. So those are the best trade. Not what I just said. I mean, how this trade
was win-win. Done.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a win-win. It's a win-win for both. I mean, both teams needed something that the other team can provide. That's the bottom line.
Exactly.
And that's the definition of a good trade. And I think this is a good trade.
And it's hard to believe, based on what you're saying, you know, trading, rebuilding, retooling, that the Raptors just won a championship in 2019 with Anunoby. Yeah?
I'm sore about that championship because they beat out my Warriors. And the Warriors were pretty much injured, and they still had a shot at winning that. But yeah, they won it. Yes.
And when you were talking defense, it made me think of Dennis Rodman. The guy couldn't shoot for squat, but he was a physical player, a great rebounder, and a defensive specialist, and he knew and understood his role. So I've always felt when you're building a basketball team, there's quite a variety of ways of building it. But then again, when you got the GOAT, the only sport where you can sit there and probably get the most consensus agreement on who the GOAT is Michael Jordan. But my point is Dennis Rodman was a specialty too. So there's always a role for a specialist in this league. I mean, and I'm digressing, but it just made me think. I remember seven-footers. They may be average at best, some of them, but they will always have a job for 10 to 12 years just because they're 7 feet and they can be a body in there. You know, I find that as hysterical. You know, so.
I think the old school centers being only, you know, down low post players, I think that's pretty much, you know, that's almost over and gone. They're not going to be very valuable to a team. There are some exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, you know, you have a Joel Embiid, you have a Nikola Jokic, you know, those type of players, you know, they're the ones that, you know, that's what the GMs are coveting now is a player like that, you know, so.
No, you're right. You're right.
So, yeah.
You're right. I agree, but I also think part of it is the one answer you can hear from everybody as the only answer, but it's only one of the answers, a part of the formula. The evolvement of the game. Players are our health, the way we eat, the supplements. We're getting bigger, stronger, faster, and that includes big men. But it's also the rule changes, wanting more offense. That's the second part. So they've relaxed some of the rules. And the third formula is cheating. I mean, ball over hand or traveling. They don't call those anymore on the superstars. It's in the rules. And the reason I say that is, that's the reason they were able to create a gambling back with Tim. What's his name again? Tim the referee.
Donaghy.
Tim Donaghy. Because he goes, those rules are there. Watch me mess Iverson's game up. And he kept calling him, what did they call it, over the hand? Dribbling?
Palming.
Yeah, that's illegal. He kept calling them and traveling too. And, you know, so they allow rules that should be enforced for the betterment of the game because I think those little rule cheats, they affect the outcome of a game. LeBron James isn't allowed to take that third step. You know, he loses 20,000 points. I'm exaggerating, obviously. But you see my point? And the reason I say that is he traveling with the 3 seconds left to lay it up. Break the rule. He doesn't get it's easy. I'm not picking on LeBron. He's just the most recognizable name today. But that's one reason I stopped being a fan. I'm not a purist, but don't cheat by not enforcing rules because it benefits your superstar player. He should have to play. You know, it's kind of like the quarterback in the NFL. Tom Brady will get that call, you know, and Kirk Cousins will be mauled, throw down, get a broken rib, a torn ACL, and they won't make the call, you know. So I always loathe referees who do that. And the league encourages that. I get it.
Well,
you got to protect your players. You got to protect your players. But you can't give them an advantage. And in basketball, they give the superstars an advantage.
Okay. Absolutely. I 100% agree with that because it frustrates me. Every time I watch a Warrior game, that Curry rarely gets any calls. He does, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, but he never gets the calls. Whereas LeBron gets every freaking call when he goes to the basket. I'm like, what is this? I mean, they're both pretty much close to the same level as far as superstar, you know, in the NBA. Pretty close. I would say LeBron's more
in the NBA. But this is where and it's funny. I just want to point this out. When you leave the NBA. Everybody's still going to know who LeBron is, but not Stephon Curry. And I'm not saying that's the reason why.
That's BS. That's BS. I'm calling you on that one, man. No way.
You can call me
and I'm not saying that's good in the Bay Area.
We can go to a stranger on the street who doesn't know basketball and go, do you know who Steph Curry is? They're going to say no.
They'll say yes. LeBron James? Yeah. They'll say yes to both.
It's like Michael Jordan and Steve Kerr. Well, maybe not Steve Kerr, but
Man.
Scottie Pippen, yeah.
Get him.
There's a big
difference. Come on, man. This is my territory, man, and I know.
It's not the sport. They are both very similar level. I'm not talking about their rings. I'm not talking about their bad.
No, I'm talking about their name recognition. They're both very similar.
When you are LeBron James, an 18-year-old lead, and then you eventually wind up with the Lakers, that is the greatest marketing tool in the NBA. Like New York with the Giants, San Francisco with the Niners. There's a transition of who, you know, Shaq is known because, hell, he was like a freak.
I know what you're saying, man. The brand of where the team that he lands at makes a difference. But I'm telling you right now, Stephen Curry has similar name recognition, not exactly, but very similar to LeBron James. LeBron James is more, but Steph Curry's not that far behind. I'll tell you that right now. And it's the truth. Research that, man. I'm telling you.
This is the difference between Eddie and I. He hedges. Well, I'm not sure, but most, you know, you're like, I'll give myself a little out here. I'm decisive. No. You go to the person who doesn't know basketball, and I'm not talking America only. I'm thinking worldwide. You know? And I may be wrong because worldwide in China. They may all know who Steph Curry is. So it depends on
everybody in the world knows who Steph Curry is.
But I can tell you, I go to Panama and I mention Steph Curry.
He changed the game.
And they won't know who he is, but they will know who LeBron is. That's just how it goes.
He changed the game as we know it right now. He did.
And what did he change?
The way that the shooting is valued way more than it was in the past. And now you have this 3-point line, which is now it's now a weapon. Whereas before it was like, what are you doing shooting the three all the time? This guy changed it so that all these kids are trying to replicate the game of Steph Curry more than LeBron James.
So this is right. I completely disagree. They didn't change the game.
You disagree, man, but that's the fact.
Let me finish. He elevated the game. The 3-point shot was created. There were great 3-point shooters. Then Steph elevated that. You know,
yes.
It's kind of like Fran Tarkenton. He was probably the purest in his time scrambling quarterback, and then Michael Vick took it to another level. You know, I always hate it when people throw the people who started this under the bus because they didn't watch him play or they're not famous or there's no film on them. And I'm not picking on you, Eddie. It's just an issue I've had because there are predecessors to everything. Nothing just starts at that level after it's already been established. It's like Dr. J. It sickens me how he has not been completely forgotten, but he's an asterisk because, oh, yeah, Dr. J. Boy, he was a high flyer. He was arguably the first high flyer. You know, he's been forgotten to a certain degree. So that's how.
Yeah, more people can identify with Steph Curry and his abilities, and they can replicate it more quickly than LeBron James's abilities. I mean, anybody can go out there and try. Was it?
I have no clue on that. I mean, I don't follow basketball in depth enough to know that.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying. That's my whole point, is that a lot of people identify with his skill set. He's only like, 6'2", 6'3", if he has like a higher, you know, sneakers that have a, you know, higher heels. But, you know, he's not that tall, but his skill set of shooting is what changed the NBA. It's changed the NBA as we speak today. And it's going to continue this way until something else happens. But everybody values shooting now because of him.
Gotcha. All right. All right. We will move on. The final question I have for you on the straight is, what are your expectations and predictions for it? Meaning, who do you think will win out on this trade? And do you think this trade will actually help make these players better players?
I think it's going to help New York more than the Raptors right now, only because New York is already a pretty good playoff team as it is right now. And I think this is just going to solidify them to be even a better playoff team. The Raptors are retooling. They're fighting for playoff positioning right now. I mean, the season's still early. But, yeah, you know, this is a better fit for them, you know, in order to essentially round out the construct of their team. You know, this is a tool that helps them more than, you know, what they had. So, yes, I agree that.
Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of somebody going to the Niners or going to the New York Giants, you know, in terms of production and how it'll work out. That makes perfect sense. All right, Eddie, talk to me about the Detroit Pistons ending their losing streak. First of all, talk to me about that, but I have to ask this question. How the hell does a coach keep his gig losing that many games?
You know, I was thinking about this, and, you know, Monty Williams is a very well-respected head coach, first and foremost. I mean, he, you know, started out at the New Orleans Pelicans, you know, kind of helped the Chris Paul, you know, at the time when he was first starting out in his career, become the player that he is today. He's very highly regarded in the NBA because of the way he communicates with his players. He did. He had a pretty good squad at Phoenix too, and you know, for whatever reason, the way that the team was constructed, it just didn't work. And you know, I think you know the last year when they didn't necessarily do that well, when they were had the expectations to do better, that was just kind of, he became the scapegoat, honestly, unfortunately, because I think the Phoenix Suns as an organization at that time was kind of going through its issues, you know, with the issues with the owner. And some of the off the court kind of issues that were going on there with respect to racism. So I think that kind of didn't help the situation. But Monty Williams, I think he's one of these type of coaches that is there to essentially instill a certain culture within a young organization, and he did that in New Orleans. And turn that organization around. And as long as, you know, the Pistons are patient, you know, I think they can be patient with him. I think that's why they're doing this, is because he was brought on board to essentially figure out what he has, who's good to stay in his system, and who needs to go, you know, out of the system. The thing is that, you know, the GM, I think, you know, let me see, what is the GM's name here? Troy Weaver, that's his name. So Troy Weaver and him, I think, are trying to figure out how to build this team moving forward. And, you know, the Pistons have really good talent in, you know, Cade Cunningham, who was the number one overall pick like 3 years ago. You have Jaden Ivey, who's a really, really explosive, you know, kind of driving kick kind of player, but he's so fast. He's an extremely fast player. So you have those two guys who are really, really good. And then you have an emerging center in Jalen Duren. And then with a backup center of James Wiseman, who's also kind of emerging as well. But the thing is that they have a lot of the same players. They have a James Wiseman. They have a Jalen Duren. They have Marvin Bagley. You know, all these guys, you know, they're similar, right? So it's like they can essentially do something with that if they were to go ahead and flip it to another team, you know, and get something right in return. So I think that he's there to being brought in to change the culture. You know, they're a young team with a lot of youth, very little as far as veterans go. I think Alec Burks might be their oldest veteran on the team. They have Bojan Bogdanovic, who's another veteran that came from the Nets. So, you know, these guys are guys that can help the youth. But I think that's the reason why he has a long leash. I think that he has the season to figure out what he has and figure out how we can fix it moving forward. So I think that's the reason why he didn't get fired. But thankfully, you know, it ended at 28, and it didn't get any worse. Because if it kept getting worse, then I think something may have happened. But maybe not till the end of the year.
And I feel like an idiot. I'm trying to I'm having a brain freeze here. The first individual, the first round pick, he's the one who literally helped win that game for him to end the losing streak. And you know what, Eddie, maybe I asked it the wrong way. I'm not, as you were chatting, I was talking, I was realizing he's got to have a decent relationship, the general manager with the owner. And because the reason I asked, why wasn't he fired already? Because that's usually an owner's first reaction to get the fans to come back and watch the games. When you start losing like that, you tend to take a hit at the stadium, which tends to circulate on down the merchandise, the food, et cetera, et cetera. So owners right. react without thinking. So he must have a great relationship with ownership to go 28 games and not get fired. You know, but I also think coaches – instill an offense and a scheme and to create a culture.
Yes.
And I think that is the basis to building the foundation to a championship. But at the end of the day, I think it's the players who make or break the head coach with the wins and losses as they implement what the coach is trying to teach him. Because the coach has no control that on there.
They have no control of how they perform. They can only exactly. set them up to for success. Exactly. What I was going to say, William, is that, you know, I'm going to bring it back to a Bay team. You know, the Warriors, for years, were a horrible franchise. For years. Okay? And you know, Don Nelson kind of got them back. Yep. You know, yeah. Don Nelson's second tenure as, you know, brought him to the league years. Yeah, he got him to respectability, but they're a very offensive-oriented team. They always have been, unless they're in the 70s, where they were, like, you know, more of a well-rounded team with Rick Barry, right. Lee Thurman, Al Adels, you know, all those guys. So, but bring it to, you know, 2011, they brought in Mark Jackson out of the broadcast booth at ESPN.
That's right.
And Mark Jackson was brought there to change the culture. He changed yep. the culture to make them a more defensive-minded team. And he had, you know, 3 years with them, and I think he instilled that culture, and the Warriors have become a very, very good defensive team. And I think the same thing's happened with Monty Williams. I think he's there to build a culture and filter out what is good for that team and what is not moving forward. And I think he's probably given some leeway, maybe a couple years to figure this out, and that's probably why you didn't see him get
and it makes sense. Yeah. Sometimes coaches aren't there to bring the championship as much as to change the culture, to set it up for whoever comes next that brings the championship. It's sad but true, and it's not meant to be that way. That just seems what happens. Like when you say mentioned Don Nelson, who's the moron, and I don't like him because of his politics, in Denver. He's retired now, white guy, balding. He's on Twitter at time, or X on time, has issues with other former players. Who is that guy?
You're talking about George Karl?
Yeah, George Karl. The George Karl yeah. and the Don Nelsons of the world. And I think George Karl may have won a ring decades ago, but I can't remember. But when I see them get hired, to me, it's like, oh, you're getting hired to change the culture. Your job is to take the losing franchise and put them on the road to a championship, but you're not going to be there to see that championship. That's kind of how I view certain coaches. And I have no clue on Monty Williams, but I do know this. They have not been above 500 since the 2015-2016 season. So maybe this was maybe the GM and the coaching staff was able to show ownership. Look,
it's the process.
Worse. Yeah, yeah. In game 10, look, owner, it could get worse. Let him develop, and that will happen. So good for the ownership on that. And these 28 straight losses I discovered in my research are the most in a single NBA season. The 76ers had 28 losses, but it was over two seasons. And during World War II, the Chicago Cardinals set the record for the four American major Canadian leagues. I couldn't find what the losses were, but I just thought it was kind of cute, nostalgic, the Chicago Cardinals, because people hear that, huh? What the hell is that? You know? People, do you remember the Feagles during World War II? The Steelers and the Eagles combined because they didn't have enough players. They were all out fighting. And if I remember, it was like this. They became the Steagles or Feagles or something like that.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's what my friend calls, my wife calls useless information that bothers her when she's trying to nap while watching her show. All right, Eddie. Thank you for that info. My final question. Can they rise above 500, or is this a completely lost year that is built
to
get that experience?
This year is meant to figure to instill that culture and to figure out what players stay and go for next year. And then this is a process of building this team up to get back to where the Detroit Pistons have been in the past.
Exactly. So what do we got next, Eddie? What's next on tap?
Well, we wanted to talk about Zion, right?
Oh, Zion. Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure if it was Cuban or Zion. I figured I'd let you decide. All right, talk to me. First of all, I love Zion Williamson. I loved him when he was at Duke. I knew he was going to leave after that first year, but I was concerned because the man loves the buffet line. He loves going from that 10-minute lifting the beer workout to going to eat on the buffet line. Now, I say this in jest, but it's a serious issue with him because of how young he is, how injury-prone he is, and how big he's ballooned up at times. So I want to lay it out to that. This has caused, not the eating, but not being able to get on the court, has caused right. his $193 million contract to no longer be guaranteed. Now, the contract was always a risky one because of his injury history. But right. tell me a little bit about how it came to be to lose a guaranteed contract. And I had no idea if you know this, Eddie, and I didn't ask it in my notes, but I'm curious. I would imagine that the union does not like seeing a guaranteed contract.
Getting revoked.
Exactly. Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, give it to the New Orleans Pelicans management for, you know, having done this where they actually had an out clause, a trigger, if you will, based on his injury history where, you know, if a certain metric wasn't hit, then they had essentially an out clause, meaning that they wouldn't necessarily make the tail end of his contract guaranteed. And that's the reason why this got triggered is because, you know, he only played like 29 games last right. year. In total, in five seasons, this guy's only played 142 games out of a possible 410, right? 410, that's like 35% being on the court. And, you know, not everyone plays all 82 games. It's rare that you see that. But you need more than 35% ability to stay on the court. I would say, you know, they were counting on him to be at least 75% available. And I think that's a pretty good expectation for, you know, a guy of his caliber. Because, you know, this kid is electric. I mean, he's a springy guy. And it's incredible that how springy this guy is at 285 pounds. I mean, this guy can jump out of the gym at 285 pounds. Can you imagine if he just lost 30 pounds? How much more athletic this guy is going to look. I mean, you compare him to like a LeBron James. LeBron James is 6'9", 250. And LeBron James is noticeably a big guy. But this yeah. guy is 285 pounds, 35 pounds more, and can jump higher than LeBron James. I mean, granted, LeBron James is almost 40 years old, right? But even at his peak, this guy jumps higher than LeBron James at 285 pounds. So, kudos to the management of the Pelicans to figure this out and come up with something that would provide some incentive, you know? And I think it can provide him some incentive. And the other thing is that even though this part of his contract is no longer guaranteed right now, he can get back that guarantee as long as he, you know, meets certain weight metrics and games played metrics. So he can get there as well as body fat metrics. So he can still get it back. So, but I got to say, I've never seen anything like this before. And I think it's actually pretty shrewd of the management to do something like this. And I think you're going to see more of this moving forward, honestly, from other players.
Oh, I don't think so. I think it's a one and done because I think the union is extremely powerful with the NBA. And
I don't think so. When it's warranted, they'll do it. When
warranted, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But the union's not about working together doing what's right. They're going to get everything. So, the unions in baseball, basketball, and even football, there's been situations where the union comes to a player who's working on specific deals and says, you can't do that part of the deal. Even when the player wants to, it's like, because you're going to set precedent, it's going to screw it up for everybody else. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, fair or not, but that's what the union is probably going to try to do in this case. You know, how I do have an, if the audience hasn't figured out, Eddie's such an optimist. I'm the more, this is going to happen, the more negative. So I do have another negative point to make. Look, some scouts have noted he's less explosive and less impactful than he was yes. just a couple seasons ago. And he's only 23. That he seems slower. That he fails to deliver on his overall play and defensive impact. And off the court with, I'm sorry, Zion, off, it took me, not being the basketball stud like you are, it took me a second to digest this. So when Zion is not playing, he's off the court. The Pelicans are 4.8 points per 100 possessions better. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I translated that. So for every 100 possessions, they're averaging about 5 points more is what I got out of it. I don't know if that's a different maker, but then again, there's a lot of close playoff games. So my question to you, Eddie, is twofold because I'm not sure. When I read this, I'm like, well, if he's fat, of course that's how he's going to be right now. He's got to lose some weight. But the understanding I got is that he's been pretty healthy this year. He's kept his weight down, and yet the scouts are saying this now about him. So how does this fit into everything you said? And I guess I'm just a little confused. Is he still a big guy, or is he down with his weight? And if he's down with his weight and they're saying this, what does that mean for him long term? Because it sounds like he may have already peaked. If that, and he's only 23. And I'm not saying that, but I'm like trying to read between the lines. That's what I kind of get out of it. But I'm a little confused on it. So break it down.
It's because primarily Zion Williamson is more of an offensive threat than a defensive player. That's the main reason why you're seeing that. And, you know, the GMs value players more that have that superstar capability like he has, but that also can do some of the defensive end work, right? Which is, you know, something that we harp on James Harden, one of your favorite guys. He's a very offensive-oriented guy, but his defense is very, very questionable. We have the same kind of thing going on with Zion. I mean, I think – see, the thing is defense requires a lot of effort, and a lot of effort – and a lot of energy, right? And this guy, he knows he doesn't have that much energy. He's more of a bursty kind of energy type of guy because of his makeup. You know, he's 285 pounds, right? So it takes a lot of energy to keep moving that 285 pounds. So he's going to conserve his energy for the offensive end so he can be explosive, which is what that team needs sometimes for him to do because he's unstoppable down low. Nobody can stop him down low. He's just too big and too strong and too athletic. But when you get him on the defensive end, people know that. He's a defensive liability because he's conserving his energy. You know, he can play defense. It's just that I think he chooses not to because of his ability to conserve, you know, of utilizing his energy on both ends of the floor. I don't think he can do it. And if he loses weight, I think it could help him for sure. But I think it's also more of an attitude too. I mean, you have to play defense well, it's an attitude. You have to want to do it. And I think players like him, they'd rather use, you know, all their energy on the offensive end because that's where all the eyes are on, is on the offensive end. That's how you get paid, is on the offensive end. The defensive end, you don't get paid as much. It's the offensive end that really does it. But now players, when they play both ends, like Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's elite at both ends, Jimmy Butler, who's elite at both ends, they get paid a lot of money because they can do both ends, right? So that's what some of these players figure out.
You know, and what you said is and that hits me hard in a way because, to me, I always talk about greatness and being great. And to me, that's what helped make Michael Jordan transcend being great and transcend. When you say the word greatness and you talk basketball, Michael Jordan is what you're saying. And the reason I say that is because you're right, Eddie. He was one of the top offensive players of all time, but he was also – and this is what I don't like about the fans, the general fan. Most fans didn't know he was also a superstar defensive specialist. I love Michael Cooper for the Lakers because he wasn't a naturally talented offensive star. He was a defensive specialist. I loved – oh, my gosh. Was it Dennis Scott for the Celtics in the 80s about that time?
Guy with the freckles.
Yeah, freckles.
Dennis Johnson. Dennis Johnson.
I loved him too. It's because it takes so much more heart. It's so much more will, so much more dedication, so much more practice. It's like me with my late hours. People are like, wow. I'm like, what do you mean, wow? I have to do that if I want this to work. Period. End of story. So when I look at those, so when you tell me that about Zion Williamson, it's disappointing to me. You know, to hear that because I'm like, oh, my God, that God-given gift. And you're not squandering it away, but you're not fulfilling it to its greatest impact. But, hey, in his defense, maybe he needs an extra cheeseburger for those carbs to get that explosive burst. Because you said the key – I can't remember the word you said, but it fell right in line with my notes in which I wrote explosive. He's an explosive player. So if he's not somebody who's going to be going 100 miles an hour back and forth, he's going to be going 40 miles and boom, be hitting 130 miles. You know,
I can just imagine how much better this guy would be 30 pounds less. He would be ridiculous. He would be better than LeBron is right now from an explosive standpoint. And LeBron, we're talking about peak LeBron, not right now LeBron.
Oh, yeah. Even right now LeBron's still better than half the league, you know?
Yeah, but he's not as explosive, you know, as, right. as he's. He's, okay. he's more of an outside shooter facilitator now. But yeah. And driver at times.
Yeah, it's kind of like the veteran wide receiver, the veteran defender of football. They can't rely on their speed and physical ability. They got to rely on the savviness of being a veteran and looking at it from that perspective and having their experience dominate the inexperience. So, yeah, I get that. You know, and the final note, and we'll move on, is sometimes no matter how good you are, no matter how talented you are, sometimes your body just doesn't play along. Meaning you're injury prone or you're something like that. And when I see Zion and his injuries, I wonder about that. Is he just, is the fact that he needs a large mass to be explosive, but he hasn't found the right formula of what that mass is versus the curbing of the eating. And then, and even if he finds the perfect size, it still may be too big to handle the bones to handle that. And this isn't every player. Every human being is unique in their makeup. And those are the worst injuries. Those are the worst careers I hate to see, because it's I hate to see a career down by injuries and being perpetually injured than the lack of talent. All right, my friend.
I wanted to segue into something still NBA related, but I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. I know you a little bit. I know you know about this more than I do, but you know I know that Mark Cuban is sold some of his ownership, you know, of the Mavericks. And I just wanted to kind of get your take as to, you know, what this is what prompted this, and what do you think is going to happen as a result of this?
The business of sports, yeah, that's something I prided myself on learning, because I felt understanding the business of sports could help you make solid business decisions for the fans out there and give them the best product. Now, Cuban said when he bought the Mavericks in 2000, he understood technology. Reading between the lines, he was going to use technology to help elevate the game, etc. On a side note, he became a billionaire when Yahoo bought his radio internet streaming company. When he sold that, I swear to God, Eddie, my wife and I think Ryan may have been in the room. I said, that's the biggest con job, because that it's they overpay for it and it's not going to exist in a couple of years. Sure, it didn't even take 6 months. He pulled the greatest con job of all. And I'm not knocking him for it. I'm just saying that's the reality of what happened. But he had vision. He was able to pull it off. So God bless him for that. You know, now that said, the valuation of the team is $3.5 billion. Now there is a difference between valuation and what you actually get financially for it. So he sold approximately 70% of his ownership. And the reason he says he sold it is because he sees real estate as an advantage in NBA ownership. And I researched this and I couldn't find it, but it's a confusing statement because, well, how is it an advantage? The advantage I see is bringing an enterprise into the area. So meaning you're not going to look just to build a basketball arena. You're going to do what baseball has done. When the Orioles built Camden Yards or Petco Park, they not only put the ballpark there, the ballpark was the heart of that whole area. So you had restaurants, hotels, tourists, everything. In San Diego, it's a beautiful event. So that's what I got out of him, because he sold it to a Vegas a group of two families. And they're gambling. They want gambling in Texas. They're fighting to get gambling. And in Las Vegas, you no longer build a hotel. You build an epicenter around the hotel. Whether New York, now known for – is it New York? Where they have all the roller coasters, they have the four hotels tied together, all the restaurants. You got the Venetian with the biblical look on the ceiling. It's an event. So that's what I got out of it. And so it's going to be governed by Patrick Dumont, Adelson's son-in-law, and he's the Las Vegas Sands president. And so that's why he did it. I was shocked. Because he lives through the Mavericks. Now, God bless Mark Cuban. What he's done as a capitalist, I marvel at. I'm not a fan of Mark Cuban, the human. You know, sexual assault issues in the complex there. he's a bigot. He's okay with the Muslims in camps in China making basketball gear. He refuses to talk about it. If he's in an interview, somebody brings it up, he chastises the person as if they're wrong for bringing up a legitimate question that the NBA condones slavery in China, because they do. That's not conjecture. That's a fact. So I'm not a big fan of his, but that said, overall, and the reason I bring this up, Eddie, I want to be real with the audience. This is who Mark Cuban is. But he's been good for the game of basketball. He's been good for the city of Dallas. And he's been phenomenally great for the franchise of the Mavericks. So I think that seeing him leave as majority owner is not a good thing for the short term. But the big thing for the long term is what the Adelsons and those families can do, bringing in the mentality of what they, how they see the future of the NBA. Because the future may not be in America. They may eventually have it in China. How they make that work, I have no clue. But so this, you build a little empire where each arena is something bigger than itself, is something good for the NBA. Now, the real quick, a little side note on the Adelsons, strong Republican donors, strong champions of Israel and the Jewish nation. Not good or bad, it's who and what they are. They are hated by half of the country, you know, the Adelsons are. So I found it ironic that Cuban, who is everything they are not in terms of how he wants you to see him as a human being and as a political individual, leads me to one conclusion. Everyone has a price. You have a price. I have a price. Everybody has a price. People who say, I don't have a price, it's because you've never been offered anything of significance, you know? But he had his price. And I'm not saying that in a good or bad way. I'm saying that that's human nature, Brother Eddie. We all have a price. Yep. So I found that interesting. And the final note on that is Cuban will be the alternate governor, meaning he'll be the de facto, if everything goes to hell with the guys running the show, and with a 27% stake. So it wasn't 70%. It looks like he sold 73% of that, which is literally, I mean, I think his stake is just to keep him in the game, you know, but he will also remain in control of basketball operations. So this is a great deal for Cuban and the NBA. I'm not sure how good a deal it is for the Mavericks short term, but the Adelsons aren't cheap. Maybe they've always struck me as willing to spend when spending is needed. So so overall, not a bad deal. There's a quote I put in my notes, and I had no clue what he was talking about, but it kind of goes in my hand of what we were talking about in terms of why going with real estate, why making that statement. But overall, a good deal for the NBA, and God bless Mark Cuban as an owner, not so much as a humanitarian. And there you have it, my friends. The sale of the Dallas Mavericks. Any questions for me, Eddie, on that?
No, I said that's a good breakdown. Thanks for educating me and the audience about, you know, what this meant, you know, long-term for the NBA, you know, this move. It could be, you know, more of a real estate thing, it sounds like, moving forward. But staying on the business side of things, you know, tell me a little bit more about, you know, the passing of Herb Cole, who used to be the Bucks owner, used to be in politics as well. You know, I just heard some news about that. And, you know, for the audience sake and for my sake, you know, I know you're pretty knowledgeable on this front. So maybe you can just share a little bit about the perspective of what this guy meant for the NBA.
Actually, I had written him out of the show. But real quick, meaning we don't have it sometimes, so I apologize to you and the audience for not letting you know. But Herb Cole, see, just like Mark Cuban is instrumental to the game of basketball, you know, meaning the fans may hate him. You know, we live in a tribalistic world where color rules over culture, over smartness. But certain things, we need to educate ourselves to become better human beings and to understand the process better. Mark Cuban is elevating basketball. Herb Cole, I don't want to say he saved basketball because I haven't finished my research, but he introduced revenue sharing. He went to the commissioner and says, if we don't get revenue sharing, this is going to be a league, and I'm speculating. I'm speculating how the conversation probably went. Herb telling the NBA commissioner, if we don't institute revenue sharing, this league is going to be a league made up of about five teams: the Knicks, the Bulls, the Lakers, and not even Golden San Francisco would have been included as part of the survivability because they were really bad losers back then. But San Diego, you know, even Miami, they weren't even around back then. But the smaller markets, they were dying. Basketball, Eddie, and hockey, at one point as kids, the only time I got to watch it, and I couldn't watch it much, was because it was on after 11:30, tape delay. That's how unpopular it was. So when people talk about Jordan and Magic and Bird saving the game, well, really, it was Magic and Bird, because Jordan came after them, who saved the game. That's what I'm talking about. And part of the key that you never hear talked about is revenue sharing. Revenue sharing is why the NFL is the number one sports in America. Now, maybe people go, whoa, basketball's number two. No, we're talking number one sport by 80 million people watching the Super Bowl on a down year to 6 to 10 million watching a great year in the NBA Finals. That's the disparity. But that's what Herb Kohl did. Herb Kohl was a champ. He's a Democrat. And for all you out there, I'm a conservative. I'm a registered Republican, but I am a conservative. I register as a Republican because they're closer to my values than the Democrat Party. But I used to be a Democrat, a liberal, not a Democrat. I used to be what you would call a blue-collar liberal, and that's what Herb Kohl was. And what the blue-collar liberal represented was you and me, the working-class Joe. And because he wanted the working-class Joe to have the same opportunities to do better. You've done better than the average working class Joe. I've done better than the average working class Joe. And it's because of people like Herb Kohl. And Herb Kohl was a champion for the small market team. You know, he bought the Milwaukee Bucks because he wanted it to stay in Milwaukee. When he sold the Milwaukee Bucks, he sold them to ownership who said, I'm only selling this if you keep the team here. And to help make the sale, he pledged like millions to build that new arena. They got, I think it was completed like 2018, right around there. Them and the new ownership built that. That's how important it was to have a professional sports team in a small market. So when I look at Herb Kohl, I look at him just as I look at Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. You know, because these are the behind the scenes individuals that saved the game of basketball. Whereas Jordan, Curry, LeBron have elevated the basketball world into a worldwide industry. Herb Kohl and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird saved the game. You know, so when I saw that he passed, and again, he was a blue collar Democrat, meaning he cared more for the people. Today's Democrat has become yesterday's Republican. They just care about the institutions they've aligned themselves with. And the Republicans are the same way. Today's political beast understands the power players don't care about the working class. And that's what makes Herb Kohl so special in my eyes. And God bless him. People may hate politicians, but there were a few. He was worth about $250 million when he served. But they say you could approach him just like you could approach a bum on the street.
That's cool.
Meaning, you know, so God bless you, Herb Kohl. Thank you for what you did. And I'm not even a big basketball fan anymore like I used to be. But when I look at him, that's greatness, Eddie. He changed the game.
That's good. I'm glad to hear.
Owners come and go. You know?
I'm glad to hear.
With that, you know, Eddie, I'm going to give you a choice here. Do we continue with the show at the one-hour mark, or do we close it and just do another football show?
Let's just close it out and do another show.
All right, my friends. There you have it. I want to remind the audience first, thank you for tuning into this All-NBA show. I love talking to Eddie and my Red, White, and Rude co-host, Sean King, because they are what you call nice guys. Sean's more like me, but the one thing I do realize is I can get these guys rattled up. Eddie, no, Guillermo, I challenge you on that one. But that's what I also love. I love people who aren't afraid to challenge. So thank you for tuning in to this NBA episode. And do not forget, you can check this show out, the sports show, our political shows, and our pop culture entertainment show at Grumblings Media, as well as on YouTube and Rumble. And please follow us there, too, under the profile Grumblings Media, as well as our traditional podcast stations, Google, Apple, Spotify, and I love to say it, it's a Pandora, you know. So until next time, on behalf of Eddie and myself, and points on the board, We bid you adieu.
Happy New Year, everyone.